From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When Thurston Clark was halfway through his journey around the equator, he had already fallen victim to insects and greedy border guards. But what really scared him was the auto accidents. On today's Fresh Air, Thurston Clark talks about his 24,000-mile odyssey along the middle of the Earth. Also today, we talk with poet Robert Pinsky, who's come to think of himself as a curator of the past. And we have reviews of the new jazz album from the German bassist Eberhard Weber and the new made-for-TV mystery, Murder by Moonlight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Many people think of the equator as nothing but a line on the globe. But to Thurston Clark, it was the longest but least visited, least appreciated natural feature on Earth, one waiting to be explored. Clark is a writer and an inveterate traveler. In 1984, he began a journey around the Earth's middle through South America, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific Islands. 6 months of travel was spread out over the course of 5 trips that spanned more than 2 years. Between trips, he returned home to New York to write up his notes. Before Thurston Clark even started his trip, he learned in the library that at the equator you find superlatives: the heaviest rat, the widest river, longest snake, highest volcanoes, biggest flower, and stinkiest fruit. There is a consistent absence of twilight and dawn. Nowhere is the sun so high in the sky at midday for so many days of the year. Over the course of his journey, Clark says he became a connoisseur of heat. He told me that in 1984 he knew it was time to travel.
I had just finished writing a novel, and I'd been in the same room for a long time, and I think I was eager to go anywhere outside of that room and outside of the house. Also, as it turned out, it was my last chance to travel, because shortly after I came back from Ecuador, my wife gave birth to twins, so I'm tied down for a while. But I did have this feeling that I think people get when they begin to be middle-aged, about that perhaps you have a last chance to finally do some great feat of travel, to go to the end of a road or the last island in the chain or the end of a river. And I was looking at a globe and trying to figure out what in the world was left that hadn't been done. And the first thing I noticed was that a lot of the great overland routes you simply can't do anymore because of wars and natural disasters. You can't go from England to India. You can't go Cape to Cairo anymore. So all of the great routes that I had read about as a boy were closed, and so I had to find something else.
Why was it the equator that you chose?
Well, it was just by chance. I was in a friend's apartment in New York on the most miserable February day, you can imagine. And he had this lovely antique globe, and I picked it up. I was still trying to figure out a route of some kind, and I gave it a big spin. And it was a globe that was constructed in 1898, so most of the countries were French blue or British red. And you spun it, and all you saw was red or blue, except for this very prominent checkered line in the middle of around the middle of the Earth, which was the equator, and that really stood out. And I held this globe up to this frosted window pane and saw the snow outside, and I thought to myself, that's when I first thought, well, this is my route.
Now, I'm sure there were times you were sorry that you chose it.
Well, a lot of people told me I was going to be sorry before I even started. I heard again and again, why do you want to go to the equator? It's all going to be nothing but steaming jungle, and it's going to be full of snakes, and it's going to be unpleasant. And as soon as I'd done a little bit of reading and thinking about it, I saw that this was absolutely the opposite of what was going to happen, that there's tremendous variety along the equator, depending on the altitude. For example, in Ecuador, I was in a snowfield on the equator, which is where the equator runs across Cayambe Volcano. There are coral atolls in the Pacific, there's desert, there's high plateau in Kenya, and of course there's plenty of the jungle as well, but there was a great deal of variety.
You know, it's easy to think of the equator as being a belt around the middle of the Earth. Is there any way that the equator's marked when you're traveling across the middle of the Earth?
Oh, yes. You mean monuments and things?
Yeah,
signs,
right.
Monuments?
Signs, monuments, sure.
Oh, yes. In fact, part of the task I set myself was to try to get to every single point in the world where the equator is crossed by a road or a train line or even a major river. And I found a great number of monuments. And the interesting thing was that each one seemed to say something about the country in which they were in fact, reflect the country in which they were in. In Brazil, in Macapá, the energetic and enthusiastic governor of Macapá was building a soccer field on the equator. So the equator would run right down the center of the field, and one team would defend the northern hemisphere, and the other would defend the southern hemisphere. In Gabon, in Africa, which is the richest country in Africa, the equatorial monument is surrounded by shards of champagne bottles because people take champagne along on a picnic, much as you'd pack a thermos of tea in another country, and they shatter the champagne bottles. In Kenya, which has a terrible overpopulation problem now, the equatorial signs that mark the equator in the middle of the road are thronged with handicraft salesmen, and every week they tell me there are more and more and more men who have come there desperate to sell a few curios to the foreigners who stop and have their picture taken by these signs.
Are there disputes in any of the countries about which part of the ground the equator is actually located on?
Well, yes, I found two disputes. The principal one was in Bandaka, in the middle of Zaire. Bandaka was originally Stanley's Equatorville. It was founded by the explorer Stanley 100 years earlier. And the Belgians, who were the colonial power in the Congo until 25 years ago, had put a brass plaque in a rock marking where the equator crossed the Zaire River. This plaque was wrenched out of the rock by President Mobutu about 20 years ago, at the same time when all of the colonialist statues were being tipped over and carted away and all of the vestiges of Belgium were being destroyed. The Africans, when I was there, said that this was not the actual equator, that was the colonialist equator, and that the Africans had the real equator, and they knew where it was. Well, nobody was particularly eager to tell me where it was, so I think it was more of a folk story than truth. In fact, I finally found out that the equator in Bandaka ran along exactly along the edge of a fence that goes around one of the satellite stations.
My guest is traveler and writer Thurston Clark. His new book, Equator, is about his travels around the middle of the Earth. You started your journey in Guyana.
Yes, in French Guyana.
Okay.
There are three, so
right.
Yes, I started in French Guyana.
Right, and this is on the northeast coast of South America. And just to set the scene here, the owner of the only hotel in French Guyana greeted you with this welcome. He said, "Welcome to the end of nowhere." Actually, it had a little kind of obscenity in there as well.
Yes.
Now, did it strike you that way, the end of nowhere?
French Guiana certainly did strike me that way. This was the only motel in French Guiana. This was a retired American sailor who had come there. It did strike me as the end of nowhere. First of all, French Guiana is the largest remaining European mainland colony anywhere in the world. It's a country with about 75,000 people, and it's about the size of Maine. And half of these people are grouped in the capital. So when you get outside of Cayenne, the capital, you find very, very few people. And those that are there are kind of people who've been swept from all four corners of the world, people who still want to live in a European colony. You find people from Indochina. You find Pieds-Noirs from Algeria. There are Dutch from Suriname who have come south after that country became independent. They're Haitians. There are a whole range of Europeans who've been kicked out of other colonial countries when they became independent. So you do have a feeling that you're there with a whole basket of scallywags. As far as being the end of nowhere, it has probably the least exploited and least explored jungle anywhere in the world. And a lot of it is protected from European exploration by the French government to protect the Indians.
There's a guy who you met there who described himself as the Johnny Carson of Guyana. And he did a radio show, and you said to him, well, why stay here? And he said, well, where else would I have such freedom to broadcast? And I was wondering if that was kind of typical of people who thought of themselves as being in the middle of nowhere, as being, you know, in a kind of hell on earth, but they thought that it was where they belonged for one reason or another.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody who I was talking to there, they all said that this is the great thing about French Guiana, is that we're completely independent, that nobody cares what we say or what we do. The Johnny Carson of French Guiana, in fact, was quite upset because he said that nobody, he said, I say the most awful things about this country and about things, and nobody cares. He said, they listen to me, but nobody cares. I think I think that was certainly the case in French Guiana, that people were there for the independence, which is strange because at the same time you have a lot of French functionaries and a lot of bureaucratic kind of social welfare state imported from Paris. But when people get there, I think they slow down and stop caring about the rules.
The first morning you woke up in a French Guiana hotel, you opened up the door and a wasp the size of a sparrow flew in. And that was just the beginning of some of the fabulous insects that you were surrounded by night and day during your travels around the equator. How did you learn to tolerate that?
Well, I had traveled quite a bit in Africa, and insects were not my fear. I found that you never know until you get to these countries what you're afraid of. My first fear in these countries has always been being killed in a traffic accident, because you see the most awful accidents. And even though there are very, very few cars, French Guiana, for example, has a terrible rate of traffic accidents. They have one road, and the Dutch Creoles from Suriname are used to driving on one side and the French drive on the other. And so once they get across the border, they often have head-on collisions. That was a fear. I've never been particularly fond of snakes, and luckily I only saw one snake in the wild, although in French Guiana I did stay at the motel. The man who owned the motel, his stepson was a snake fancier and had filled aquariums upstairs with poisonous snakes. I asked his mother, when she came, gave me a tour of these snakes, and I said, well, where does he find them, imagining them expeditions up remote rivers. And she said, Monsieur, he finds them everywhere, most of them within 100 yards of the hotel and at night. So after that, I used a flashlight at night when I was walking around that motel.
In your travels through Africa, you had some very unpredictable travel problems with visas and special permits that you needed. When you got to Gabon in Africa, a small country, you didn't have the right visa to write. And the Minister of Information told you that you would have to write each of approximately 50 other ministers and ask for their permission to write while you traveled. I mean, how are you supposed to know about these things before you get to a country?
Well, I did know about them, but what you're supposed to do if you're in my situation, which is traveling around on a tourist visa, is you're supposed to stay as far away as possible from anybody who works in the government. And I made the mistake, which I never repeated after that, of going and imagining that this man who worked for the Ministry of Tourism and Information was actually going to help me with a problem, and he'd been recommended to me. But you cannot, especially in Africa, go and announce yourself, particularly if you're on a tourist visa, as a writer. Otherwise, they want you have to get a whole bunch of permissions from the different government ministries. In fact, he cut the list down to 6 or 7, but I immediately got out of the capital as fast as I could. In fact, when I was in, I did a book 10 years earlier in Africa about the Tuareg in Niger, and I had to get a letter from the president himself saying that I could stay and interview people and research.
You write that if you want to see neocolonialism that torments Africans every day, stand near a roadblock. There were lots of roadblocks that you crossed during your passage through Africa. What were some of the reasons for the roadblocks?
Well, there are different official reasons given. They are to prevent the movement of people into the cities, to regulate that so the cities don't become overcrowded. They're to prevent smuggling. They are to check also the papers and insurance forms and things that the cars are supposed to have, to check people's identity papers, particularly where there's a fear of guerrillas, insurgency in the countryside. Of course, these are exactly the same reasons that the colonial powers had for instituting these roadblocks across Africa. And in many cases, the habit has just not died. It's a colonial habit. It's not an African habit. And it's been perpetuated by the African governments. Some roadblocks are kind of, the one in Gabon, are kind of jolly affairs where everybody has a beer and talks and nothing too terrible happens. But in places like Uganda, people are murdered at roadblocks. In other countries, a great deal, there's extortion that takes place at these roadblocks.
Yeah, you make it sound like a lot of the roadblocks are really bribe opportunities.
Yes, they are.
In Uganda, you met teenage soldiers who, you know, demanded you give them something. One of the soldiers said, give me cigarettes, but you didn't smoke, so you couldn't give them any of that.
Yes, that was a particularly unpleasant roadblock because it was the exact same roadblock where several Europeans had been murdered within the last year. I didn't realize this until I was just about to get on the plane for Kampala. I thought that I would be avoiding some of the worst roadblocks by flying there. But I had been I didn't know that this was the airport at which, the roadblock at which the Europeans had been killed until the last minute. So when I got there, I was quite reasonably fearful. But I assumed that I could just give him some money or something. And what he wanted was cigarettes. And the problem is I don't smoke. And I had I didn't have the presence of mind to say, well, have something else. I just kind of stammered that I didn't smoke. And then he banged the car, and he said, you must have something for me. And I reached into my pocket. Some of the other soldiers were picking up their guns and beginning to stagger over to the taxi. And I reached in, and I found the buttons of the Great Equatorial Expedition. These were something I had made up to give to people along the way. I thought they'd be popular, but they were incredibly unpopular. People really wanted a little bit of money or a T-shirt or something. But I handed these out to the Ugandan soldiers, and they loved them. They pinned them on each other. They threw mock salutes. They laughed. They asked for buttons for their children. In fact, it's the only place in the equator where my buttons were at all popular. And then we drove on from there, and the taxi driver stopped, and he turned around, and he said, dear sir, you simply must stop at the next door and buy cigarettes for these soldiers, or we cannot go on. So that's precisely what we did.
Well, I want to talk with you more about some of your experiences and adventures traveling around the equator. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Thurston Clark, and his new book, Equator, tells of his travels following the equator around the world. He traveled through Africa, Asia, South America, and the Pacific Islands on and off for almost 3 years. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Thurston Clark is joining us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. You visited the Virunga Mountains where the mountain gorillas are. These are the same mountain gorillas that Diane Fossey worked to save. These are the mountain gorillas in the movie Gorillas in the Mist. I thought you had a very interesting reaction to the mountain gorillas. You saw the whole reserve as a kind of neo-colonial experience.
Yes, I did. Most of the visitors, in fact, practically all of the visitors, were European, or Americans and Europeans, who paid a great deal of money to go there. There are very few gorilla watching slots available. There are kind of six people go at a time, maybe 18 or 20 people a day. And people pay a tremendous amount of money to do this. And I found that the people who lived in the fields right next to the gorillas, the same fields through which we were tramping with our safari gear into the mountains to see the gorillas, had never seen a mountain gorilla. In fact, some of them were unsure as to exactly what they looked like. They had seen the face in pictures and things, but they weren't sure what the whole body looked like. This is the case, of course, in a lot of the game parks, that Europeans are much more interested in the animals and wild animals than Africans.
So to some of the Africans, the gorillas seemed like they were there for the whites.
That's right. They said, two or three people said to me, they're for you, les blancs, and they would kind of hold out their hands as if they were a present to us. The people, the conservationists there, have done very good work, though, I should say, educating the farmers as to the importance of the gorilla habitat, the bamboo forest in which they live, as a water resource, because this forest kind of soaks up water like a sponge and then slowly releases it to the farmers' fields. So I think the farmers, from the surveys that have been done, they do understand the importance of the gorillas for their farms, and certainly the government officials in Rwanda understand the importance of the gorillas for foreign exchange, because they earn a tremendous amount of foreign exchange for Rwanda. But still, the Africans, the people who I talked to who lived right around it had really no affection for the gorillas as such.
The equator is a place of extremes, extreme heat, virtually no sunrise or sunset. The sun rises and sets very suddenly. No twilight. Is it a place of extreme living conditions as well? Did you find that the people lived in extremes just as the climate expressed an extreme?
There was such variety. I mean, some countries, Sumatra, for example, was relatively well off, the people there. The people in Africa were a lot of the people I found on the equator in Africa were, quite impoverished. One thing that I did find that united everyone was what I considered a certain heroism. Now, perhaps to explain this, I should say when I was in Uganda, I gave a talk at Makerere University and to the English class. And the literature that they were analyzing was Alistair MacLean and Robert Ludlum, these paperback thrillers that had been cast off by expatriates. And afterwards, I was talking to one of the students, and I said, don't you have any other access to any other books? And he said, no, sir, we don't, and we know what this literature is. He said, but you see, this is the only time we're ever going to be students, and so we must deal with what we have because we want to make the most of our one and only precious lives. And I found that this is something that I found elsewhere. I found people struggling to make the most of their one and only precious lives. The man who realized finally in Kinshasa that he was going to have to smuggle ivory if he wanted to support his family. There were other cases. And I think this is, of course, something that we all try to do. And so I found this a constant around the equator. There were several other things that I found that were that you found almost everywhere you went.
But well, what was that? Because this was something of a theme trip, so I'm wondering what what themes emerged from it.
Well, there were some. One of the themes, which we've already touched on, was the overpopulation, which I found in Kenya and in the Pacific atolls. Another theme is I found the VCR was having a tremendous effect. The taped movies were really... I think it's somewhat, you know, 20 years ago, everybody said 25 years ago that radio coming to third world countries was creating great political changes. It was attracting people to the cities. And now, I found that in the smallest villages in Africa, in the smallest, most remote atolls in the Pacific, people were able to see three or four Hollywood movies a week because all you need is a TV set, a generator, and a library of pirated tapes. And so that suddenly people all over the world are seeing visual images of great wealth. And it's going to have, I think, a tremendous effect on their culture. It's going to pull more and more people out of the countryside into the cities looking for the things that they can now see, visualize. And so I think the VCR, and this I found everywhere along the equator, that people had just seen the VCR in the last 2 years.
Toward the end of your journey, you got real sick. You got stricken with some rare intestinal parasites that it took you a really long time to get rid of. You ate at a restaurant that served you bad seafood?
Yes. It was supposed to be one of the best restaurants in town, but it's always the case. I mean, I've been to India, and the only time I got sick in India was I ate in one of those fabulous romantic hotels that they're always advertising for tourists, and I had been given a free meal courtesy of the tourist department there, and I was poisoned for days. I have no fear of eating on street stalls or eating in the most simple restaurants as long as the food is cooked. If you see them cook the food and you know they've cooked the food and it's well cooked, there's no problem. But if you go to some of these fancy restaurants, they bring something out of the kitchen. You don't know how long it's been sitting around. Actually, it turned out that my guide who took me up to Kayumbe Volcano, which is where the equator runs across that ice field, had eaten in the same restaurant the following night and so arrived looking absolutely like death and was one day further away from healing. And we kind of shared cups of tea and Lomatil on the drive up to the equator.
Did these parasites help end your journey?
No. What ended my journey slightly early was an earthquake, the earthquake in Ecuador. Which happened, I was planning to go to Ecuador, I think it was the 4th or 5th of March several years ago, and take a bus down this road to Lago Agria down in the jungle. The road kind of parallels the equator. And at the last minute, I changed my mind because I realized it was the equinox was coming up and the sun would be absolutely overhead the equator. And so I would wait for 2 or 3 weeks to go to Ecuador. And I'm glad I did because on that exact night that I was planning to be taking a bus down into the jungle, there was the terrible earthquake. And a number of the buses were just entombed in feet of mud and everybody was killed. So I think that is in some ways the closest call I had. I mean, I had my ticket booked and everything was set. And I just at the last minute changed my mind.
Well,
and that did cut the trip short because I wasn't able at the time. The roads were cut and there was no way to get down to the jungle part of Ecuador.
Do you do all these travels just to write books about them?
This was specifically a trip that I was going to write about. In 1970, after I finished graduate school in African and Middle Eastern studies. I took an enormous trip around Africa. I hitchhiked. I went by train. I went all the way down West Africa, down the coast of West Africa. I hitched down Southern Africa. I came up through East Africa and Ethiopia. I went all over the place, and that was simply for the joy of travel. I didn't write about that. Then I did write a book about the Tuareg nomads during the drought of 1975, and I did write a book about that, but that was something that I was determined to do whether or not anyone would publish it. That was something I'd wanted to do for many years.
So tell me, when you're traveling through the equator, do you use sunscreen?
I use a big, first of all, I have a big hat. I'm balding, so I have to have a really big hat to keep the sun off the top of my head. Mostly, I just put it on my nose. I'm lucky that I don't burn. I have this kind of skin that tans very easily, and so I just watch out for my nose. I think the problem is in these countries that they're so hot. If you cover yourself up with sunscreen, you're just miserable because you're perspiring. It's like wearing a suit of polyester clothes or something. I mean, it's not the thing to wear in these countries. The best solution is just to stay out of the sun as much as possible and wear a hat.
One other question about the parasites that you got.
Yes.
How long did it take you to get rid of them?
It took me over a year and lots of courses of antibiotics, but finally they have gone, I hope.
When you were going through that year of not being able to get rid of them,
mm-hmm.
were you having second thoughts about your trip?
No, I've never had second thoughts about the trip. I think... because I travel, as I think a lot of people do, as much for the experience itself and for enjoying the travel as, first of all, for the anticipation of travel, and second, for the memory. And I think that travel is a way in which we enrich and nourish our interior lives, that constantly I am walking around and seeing things that will remind me of episodes and people I met during the 6 months. And I find that it's enriched my interior life. You know, some people believe that that's one of the, of course, reasons that people read, for the same reason, to enrich their interior lives, to nourish these lives. And I think that this may be why travel writing and travel literature is so enduring and has become so popular and continues to be so popular, because it kind of stands at the intersection of these two methods of nourishing your interior life, travel and reading.
Let me point out that you said you love about travel the anticipation and the memory, but it always seems that the travel itself is so filled with hardship that's not very enjoyable in itself.
Physical hardship, yes, but I think that the people that I met, I think, more than make up for it. I think at the end of the book I said that I would always think of the equator as a necklace of people stretching around the world, and I found that those encounters certainly make up for it. You remember, as well, of course, you remember the few times that you were terribly ill. But in general, I found that I was no less uncomfortable than I would be at home. A lot of the days went by without great suffering. But, of course, you don't mention those in the book. I don't mention those in the book. It would be rather dull if I told everybody, well, today I felt fine. So maybe it comes across. I think that the few times I was sick or perhaps come across as more important than they were.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thurston Clark's book, Equator, is published by William Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a look at what goes on behind the camera in television sports with producer Terry O'Neill. O'Neill worked at CBS and ABC, heading up broadcasts of Monday Night Football, Super Bowls, and the Olympics. He has a new book, The Game Behind the Game, High Stakes, High Pressure in Television Sports. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Pinsky had fantasies of being a jazz musician or a bum, but he became a poet and essayist instead. Coming up, he reads and discusses his poems. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from bassist Eberhard Weber. His ECM records were forerunners of New Age music. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Murder by Moonlight, starring Brigitte Nielsen as the agent sent to investigate an outer space murder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. A Panamanian journalist covering an opposition party rally today was shot in the chest by a plainclothes security officer as the vote count from yesterday's presidential election was suspended. The government's election tribunal reports that it's not received the tally sheets from regional voting centers. Opposition leaders say many of the official tabulations have been stolen by pro-government forces because they show the ruling party losing. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Panama City.
Across Panama City today, opponents of General Manuel Noriega gathered on street corners to demand that the Panamanian government recognize what the opposition says was a landslide victory in yesterday's election. At one location, an opposition march was broken up by riot police and paramilitary squads armed with tear gas and shotguns. Poll results collected by the opposition show General Noriega's designated presidential candidate, Carlos Duque, trailing the opposition candidate, Guillermo Endara, by a 2-to-1 margin. But the government continues to insist that an exit poll it commissioned proves that Carlos Duque won. They have not yet come up with any vote totals to support their claim. What happens next may depend on the international delegations that have come to observe the election process here. Former President Jimmy Carter has been portrayed in the pro-Noriega papers as an impartial judge of the election process. If he now denounces the government, it could have a major impact. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
The space shuttle Atlantis glided to a successful landing on a runway at Edwards Air Force Base in California this afternoon. During its 4-day mission, Atlantis deployed a space probe named after the explorer Magellan that will transmit pictures of the surface of Venus. The 5 shuttle astronauts were welcomed back to land with these words from Mission Control in Houston.
Atlantis, Houston, understand we'll stop. Congratulations and nice landing. You've extended the shuttle's reach far beyond Earth orbit now. Commodore Magellan would approve.
A smaller-than-expected crowd of some 27,000 welcomed Atlantis home. The $550 million Magellan probe launched by Atlantis marks the return of the U.S. to planetary exploration after an 11-year absence. In Geneva, the World Health Organization has opened its annual meeting, with the top item on the agenda being the application by the Palestine Liberation Organization to become a member of the health organization. The U.S. has threatened to end its funding of the WHO if Yasser Arafat's group is admitted. Health and Human Services Secretary Louis Sullivan met today with WHO's general director to stress the administration's concern. Israeli troops sealed off the occupied territories today, preventing West Bank and Gaza Arabs from entering Israel proper. Authorities say they fear attacks as Israel holds back-to-back national holidays. At first, the Jewish state honors its war dead. That's followed by Israeli Independence Day beginning at sunset tomorrow. In a Memorial Day speech today, Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said Arab terrorism has reached new heights of violence and murderousness against the Israeli people. Hospitals on the Gaza Strip indicate that Israeli troops wounded 10 Arabs, including 2 children, when they opened fire with rubber bullets. In Israel proper, hundreds of Israeli Jews staged protests today and in some cases attacked Arabs. The protesters were angered by reports and the discovery yesterday of the body of an Israeli soldier who was apparently murdered and then buried on the Gaza Strip. Police used force to break up some of those Jewish demonstrations. New talks began today on the future of U.S. bases in Greece. The talks are taking place in Athens, and there are the final negotiations before next month's Greek general election. Unless a new agreement is signed, the U.S. has to pull out by June of 1990. On Wall Street, stock prices lost ground today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 5.5 points to close at 2376.49. Declines led advances 9-5 on a volume of 135 million shares. Once again, the Dow lost nearly 5.5 points to close at 2376.49.
This is Fresh Air. German bassist Eberhard Weber has been a mainstay of the ECM record label since the mid-70s. He's made records under his own name and with fellow ECM artists such as vibraphonist Gary Burton, guitarist Pat Metheny, and saxophonist Jan Gabarek. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Weber helped shape ECM's influential, spacious sound, a sound that's been a prime source for New Age music. Kevin hates New Age music, but he says he's always had a soft spot for Weber.
If I made up a list of everything I don't like about many modern jazz records, spacey textures, lots of echo and overdubs, a highly processed bass sound, a shortage of blues harmony, I'd have a pretty good description of Eberhard Weber's new album on ECM. The only thing is, I kind of like the album, which goes to show that no matter what you believe in theory, sometimes you gotta go with your gut. One reason this music works for me is that Weber has a great sense of mood, as you can hear on his composition, Before Dawn. That sneaky reference to As Time Goes By underlines the piece's tick-tock rhythm. Of course, these days, some instrumental records are all mood and no substance. But Weber is an adept bassist who likes to improvise, and somehow he lets his personality emerge through his heavily amplified sound instead of losing it in that sound. Eberhard Weber's new album is called Orchestra, though only 9 players put in appearances, and most tracks are for solo or overdub basses. The title Orchestra refers to the wide range of effects Weber gets from his 5-string bass. He coaxes an orchestra's worth of sounds from his instrument. Still, in an effort to show what his bass can do, he underutilizes his 9 brass players. I'd wish he'd given them more than 2 tracks to play on and more room to stretch. At least Weber himself cuts loose once in a while. Early in his career, he worked a lot backing American jazz musicians in Europe. Like the good improviser he is, he's developed his own vocabulary. That's one piece where I wish he'd played unamplified, like a traditional jazz bassist. But Weber makes the music he wants to make, jazz or not. His composition, Too Early to Leave, for basses and 6 brass from tuba on up, owes more to Terry Riley's early minimalism than to jazz. Thank you. Oddly enough, the distance Weber puts between himself and the jazz tradition may be what makes this music work. It succeeds on its own terms. We critics sometimes write as if anyone who's ever played jazz is obliged to play only jazz ever after, but that's silly. The jazz tradition exists to liberate musicians, not stifle them. A player should be free to go off in any chosen direction, at least as long as the music's good. It's when musicians stifle themselves that they get into trouble. Orchestra isn't the best album Eberhard Weber has made. I still like his first for ECM, 1973's The Colors of Chloe. But his new album is okay.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Poet Robert Pinsky says he has a kind of pitying mistrust toward all literary criticism. On the other hand, Pinsky also writes literary criticism. His latest book of essays is called Poetry and the World. Pinsky is also a professor of English at Boston University. He grew up in a small town on the Jersey Shore. In one of his essays, he writes that he's interested in the process of mythologizing and glamorizing. I asked him how that related to writing about his hometown and growing up.
I think there's a typical relation to a provincial place, a kind of a crummy little place, where the person who grows up in it and then feels not a complete success in it, sometimes that person then becomes the curator of the place. My town, Long Branch, New Jersey, is something that still preoccupies me. Times I've been back there, it looks to me obliterated. It's just a terrible mess. The boardwalk that I remember is mostly gone. There are condos there. And it occurs to me that I'm the one who takes care of that old Long Branch of the 50s and 60s. I am still writing about it and thinking about it. It's mine now. And perhaps someone else who was in school and did very well and was happy with themselves socially and academically has accepted the change of the town. I'm still back there trying to do it over right.
Well, there's a poem that I think is a real perfect example of your description of yourself as the curator of the town. Would you read your poem, The Questions?
Sure. I probably should say that my dad was one of the many people who had stores on the main street in the town. My grandpa had a bar. My father sold eyeglasses. What about the people who came to my father's office for hearing aids and glasses, chatting with him sometimes a few extra minutes while I swept up in the back, addressed packages, cleaned the machines? If he was busy, I might sell them batteries or tend to their questions. The tall, overloud old man with a tilted, ironic smirk to cover the gaps in his hearing. A woman who hummed one prolonged note constantly. We called her the Hummer. How could her white, fat husband, he looked like Reverend Peel, bear hearing it day and night? And others, a coquettish old lady in a bandeau, a European. She worked for refugees who ran gift shops or booths on the boardwalk in the summer. She must have lived in winter on Social Security. One man always greeted my father in Masonic gestures and codes. Why do I want them to be treated tenderly by the world now, long after they must have slipped from it one way or another, while I was dawdling through school at that moment, or driving, reading, talking to Ellen? Why this new superfluous caring? I want for them not to have died in awful pain, friendless. Though many of the living are starving, I still pray for these dead. Mostly anonymous, but Mr. Monk, Mrs. Rose Vogel, and barely remembered, that they had a little extra, something for pleasure, a good meal, a book, or a decent television set. Of whom do I pray this rubbery, low-class charity? I saw an expert today, a nun, wearing a regular skirt and blouse, but the hood or headdress navy and white around her plain, probably Irish face, older than me by 5 or 10 years. The post office clerk told her he couldn't break a 20, so she got change next door and came back to send her package. As I came out, she was driving off with an air, it seemed to me, of annoying, demure good cheer, as if the reasonableness of change, mail, cars, clothes, was a pleasure in itself, veiled and dumb, like the girls I thought enjoyed the rules too much in grade school. She might have been a grade school teacher, but she reminded me of being there, aside from that, as a name and person there, a Mary or John, who learns that the janitor is Mr. Woodhouse, the principal is Mr. Ringlaven, the secretary in the office is Mrs. Apostolakis, the bus driver is Ray.
Can I ask you one of the questions that you ask in your poem? Why
Yes.
do you want these people to be treated tenderly by the world now? Why do these people preoccupy you now?
It's such a mystery. It's the mystery of why we care about those we know. And I suppose the traditional religious injunction to love your neighbor as yourself, if you extend it to love your neighbor's children as your own. And I think many of us even do strive to do that. But there's some sense in which the old lady I knew means more to me than the old lady you knew. And at some level, it's really appalling. I mean, each of us with his own little teddy bear that he liked. And I think it's worth thinking about a long time. If I could answer the question, the poem would have been called The Answers, Terry.
Well, one of the things I find interesting, though, is that when you were growing up, these people lived in the world of the adults. But now that you're older, these people live in the world of your past, the people who
Yes.
were the minor characters in your past, and now you're kind of excavating them in a way, maybe to better understand your past.
Perhaps so. It comes back to that interesting question of why some people become the holder of something that was. Dublin didn't think it was Joycean, to take an example of the greatest of modern writers for me. Dublin didn't feel Joycean to itself, and Joyce couldn't live there. He became an exile from it. And now, Dublin is Joyce's Dublin. That Dublin is, anyway. And why that happens and how it happens is peculiar. Probably if I accepted these people and their world more entirely, I'd be back in the town selling eyeglasses and hearing aids to their equivalent. And it was some feeling of difference then that makes me ask myself what the feeling of sameness or closeness is now.
I'm sure that the bus driver named Ray and all the people who you mentioned by name in this poem would be astonished to know even that you remembered their names, let alone that you were including them in a poem.
That's part of the thrill of the poem. They'd be particularly astonished because I didn't like the principal, so I made him the janitor. And the secretary, I made the guidance counselor the secretary. I didn't care for her much either. And I liked the secretary very much. Her name was Ringlaven, so I made her principal. So if they're out there, this is, I'm boss in the poem, just as you were boss in the school.
Right, this is the power that you have now.
But the other people, Mr. Monk and Mrs. Rose Vogel, were called Mr. Monk and Mrs. Rose Vogel.
Let's get back to something we were talking about before. We were talking about how you're interested in the process of mythologizing and glamorizing, and you explained that you sometimes use that to go back to the past and to penetrate the past and maybe even better understand the past. Do you do that in the present? Do you think that you mythologize and glamorize the present through writing about it?
I think everybody makes all day. I think that art is an extension of the kind of things that people do. In a housing tract, when it first goes up, the houses all look alike. And 10 years later, they're landscaped differently. They're painted differently. People have added to them differently. And as sloppy as we may look when we get dressed, we are making little works of art that are how we look that day. And for me, making poems is just a kind of very conscious and specialized extension of that making. It isn't only mythologizing and glamorizing, it's making something of it.
You've written that sometimes you're afraid that poetry has just become hobby, that it's just seen as hobby now.
I suppose that's a sour way to put something that's also one of the glories of poetry. That is, poetry isn't a commodity. We never read in the paper that a Sydney sonnet has just been sold for $3 million, the way a Rembrandt painting might have been. You know, and you memorize a poem, it's yours. And it's just as good as somebody who can buy the manuscript and hang it on their wall. And because poetry's instrument is one person's voice, and its material is words, which we all use every day, there's an extent to which poetry resists being turned into a commodity. And so if there's a glorious word for a hobby, that means an art that does not easily lend itself to being bought and sold, then maybe I should accept that.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us and for reading some of your poetry.
Pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Robert Pinsky's book of essays, Poetry and the World, is published by Echo Press, which also published Pinsky's latest collection of poems, History of My Heart. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We're going to be hearing about the election in Panama and some thoughts about what the United States might do next with respect to the Panamanian elections. We'll also be hearing about Andreas Papandreou's Greek socialists. They're having their problems. A lot of attention in the tabloids has been given to Papandreou's marital problems. But beyond that, he has some serious economic troubles and fears in Greece about what the new economic common market is going to mean for Greece in 1992. And we'll also be talking with a couple of members of the Plastic People of the Universe. Of course, you're familiar with their work.
Who are they, Robert?
great Czechoslovakian rock group, I'm assured.
Okay, thanks. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two of this week's most hyped TV programs are set in times other than our own, one the past and the other the future. Television critic David Bianculli had a hard time deciding which show to pick for this week's review.
May is one of those super competitive sweeps periods when the networks present their best stuff and their worst stuff in hopes of getting big ratings. This week, that super competitive frenzy leaves me with a problem. Should I devote this week's review to War and Remembrance, the longest miniseries in TV history that's finally ending 6 years after Winds of War began? Or to Murder by Moonlight, a toss-away made-for-TV sci-fi movie that stars Brigitte Nielsen? Given a subject as monumentally important as World War II, and a subject as astoundingly irrelevant as a murder mystery set on a futuristic moon base, the choice is obvious. The plot of Tuesday's CBS telemovie Murder by Moonlight, like everything else about it, is simple. The year is 2015, and a bunch of Americans are working at a lunar mine that's owned and leased by the Russians. A crew member is killed, and an investigator from each country is sent to solve the murder. Julian Sands plays Kirilenko, the Soviet agent, and Brigitte Nielsen plays Maggie Bartok, the American agent. When she arrives at the base, she takes off her spacesuit to reveal an outfit that's 20% leather, 20% sequins, and 60% cleavage. The officer who greets her is understandably taken aback.
Bartok! Where the hell have you been?
At the Bastille Day party over at Europa.
That was 2 days ago.
I couldn't get a ride back.
Now, if you're wondering what a ride back is, it's just an example of how Brigitte Nielsen manages to put the wrong emphasis in almost every sentence she speaks. Julian Sands, meanwhile, has his character talking like Boris Badenov, so their scenes together have a certain bizarre charm. His accent is Badenov, and hers is even worse.
I know you're KGB, but I am not CIA.
No code books.
No cyanide capsules.
Nothing up my sleeves but my elbows.
What do you say? Friends for the duration?
You know, I am continually amazed by the faith Americans put in their callous charm. One day, when I have absolutely nothing useful to do, I must study this phenomenon.
As a pure exploitation film, or one with a sense of humor, Murder by Moonlight comes up empty. It's got one love scene that looks like an MTV video, and Nielsen's uniform gets gradually unbuttoned as the case gradually unravels, but Murder by Moonlight is no Barbarella. It's so completely inept, though, that it's kind of a kick to watch. Brigitte Nielsen doesn't act at all. She just stands there and fills her uniform. But you could say the same thing about Robert Mitchum in War and Remembrance. He's the least watchable part of that TV program, while Brigitte Nielsen is the most watchable part of hers. You take it from there.
Hi. Maggie Bartok again. I don't think I caught your name.
I have no patience with intentional obtuseness.
Was it something I said?
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we meet novelist Catherine Dunn. Her new book, Geek Love, is the story of a young couple who intentionally breed a family of mutants and start their own freak show. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles one of the fathers of rock and roll, Chuck Berry. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new collection of short stories by Soviet writer Tatiana Tolstoya, the great-grandniece of Leo Tolstoy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Overture by Schumann that's modeled on a...